Fourth case for argument this morning is United States against Robinson. Mr. Goetze.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Adam Goetze, and I appear on behalf of defendant appellant Mr. Anthony Robinson. Today, Mr. Robinson respectfully requests this Court to vacate his bribery conviction and remand the remainder of the case for a new trial based on three errors of the District Court. First, the District Court committed reversible error by failing to provide the jury with the written instruction concerning Mr. Robinson's coercion defense. Second, Mr. Robinson's bribery conviction was flawed as the District Court allowed the government to improperly rely upon salaries paid to the officers to prove a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 666. And third, because there was insufficient evidence to support a finding the Chicago Police Department received $10,000 of federal funding, a prerequisite of Section 666. With regard to my first point, Your Honors, at the District Court, Mr. Robinson's sole theory of defense was coercion. Given that Mr. Robinson's case rested entirely upon this theory, the jury instruction regarding the same was critical. However, the jury instruction regarding Mr. Robinson's coercion instruction was inexplicably missing from the set of written instructions provided to the jury for use during deliberations.
How do we know that?
We
know it was missing from a set of instructions posted on the docket. How do we know that it was missing from the set of instructions furnished to the jurors?
Your Honor, we know because if you look at the set of instructions posted to the District Court docket, there's a missing page 19.
Yes, we know that. But you could equally say we therefore know that the instruction was not read to the jurors, but it was quite obviously read to the jurors. The district judge appears to have sent to the jury the instructions as he read them. The question is, where did page 19 get lost? Did it get lost between the giving of the instruction in open court and the giving of it to the jurors physically? Or did it get lost between then and when the electronic files were posted on the docket? How do we know it was lost before the first of these rather than the second?
Your Honor, is our position that it was lost before?
How do we know that is my question.
Well, it is not known for certain if instructions posted to the district court's docket do not necessarily match the set used by jury during deliberations. As you point out, as also pointed out by the government in their response brief.
Was there any obligation of the district judge, on the district judge, to post those to the docket? Was that a required act by the judge?
By the judge?
Right.
All docket entries are certified by the district court clerk.
Of course, but does the judge have to docket his or her instructions?
I am not aware of any requirement of the judge himself or herself to have to docket.
As far as I know, there's no requirement that the district court clerk do it either. Right, but the docket will say something like, jury charge, jury retires, verdict returned. The instructions will not be separately posted in the docket. There's no legal requirement of it.
There may not be an requirement, but in this case, the district court clerk did post the documents to the docket.
We know that that happened, right? We're trying to figure out whether there's any inference to be drawn from the fact that something is missing. Now, ordinarily, one would say, if you don't know what inference is to be drawn, we got a silent record about where this went missing. And what we also have is failure to object in the district court. The district judge presumably could have inquired and found out when page 19 was eaten by the dog, right? But in the absence of an objection in the district court, we don't know. We're here on plain error review, and the usual consequence of a silent record on plain error review is the defendant loses. Doesn't that give you something of a problem?
Well, first off, as set forth in our opening brief, Our contention is that we are here on de novo review. The government set forth that we are here in plain error.
The probability of your prevailing on that is negligible.
Well, even proceeding on a plain error review, it is still our contention that the jury instruction was not included in the set of instructions.
I know that's your contention, but we're back to the problem how the record shows that. The only thing we know in the record is that by the time these got posted on the docket, page 19 was gone. We don't know when it went missing.
Well, Your Honor,
one can say till you're blue in the face that it's our contention that it never went to the jury, but without any evidence for that, it goes nowhere.
Well, Your Honor, even though I understand your question, but in this case, there was a docket and it was posted to the
Mr.
docket.
Getzo, I hate to pile on here, but the other problem with this argument is that there is no evidentiary support for the giving of a coercion instruction in the first place. And so, to establish a violation of your client's substantial rights is going to be really, really hard. I mean, there was no evidence that he was in immediate fear of death or serious bodily injury unless he committed the offenses in question in this case, and there's no evidence that he had no reasonable opportunity to refuse to commit the offense and thereby avoid the injury. So the instruction should not have been given in the first place, and you've led with your weakest argument. So maybe you want to move on to the next one.
Okay. Well, moving to my second point, plain error was committed when the district court permitted the government to rely upon salaries paid to the police officers to prove a violation of Section 666. In Section 666A2, there's a transactional element that requires proof that the alleged bribe was in connection with any business, transaction, or...
It sounds like you agree that our standard here is plain error. Was there any objection to the instruction? Presumably you could have asked your predecessor. I'm not blaming you. Your predecessor could have asked for an instruction that told the jury to ignore the salary business, but no such request was ever made.
There was no objection or request made on my predecessor's behalf.
It's something of a problem. Of course, the reason for the contemporaneous objection requirement was so problems like this can be fixed.
Well, as I said before, there was no objection. We are contending that this is to be reviewed on plain error. Section 666A2 contains a transactional element that requires proof that the alleged bribe was in connection with any business, transaction, or series of transactions of an entity involving the value of $5,000 or more. An additional section of the statute, Section 666C, explicitly excludes the use of salaries to reach the enumerated value requirement of $5,000. This statute does not limit this exclusion, but rather states directly and clearly that it does not apply to salary, wages, or other compensation paid in the usual course of business.
But isn't that talking about the bribe, not the element of $10,000 in public funds?
The $5,000 is in reference to the bribe. $10,000 is the federal funding. That's correct. As the Sixth Circuit in United States versus Mills set forth,
is there any argument here that the evidence of the jury, evidence properly before the jury about the value of the bribe, would not have supported a verdict that the bribe was worth $5,000? And it looks like this was a $1,000 bribe to be repeated periodically. So if you try to take the present value of that promise, what's it come out to?
Well, there was no agreement as to how long this bribe relationship was supposed to occur.
That in criminal cases, agreements that look like mortgages about how many times the bribe will be repeated are pretty uncommon. But would you think that a reasonable jury could not have found that this would be repeated five times?
I do not think so. And in fact, the evidence sets forth only $1,100 was paid. The $5,000 amount, and this relationship continued for 6 weeks, over 5 weeks. And there was no evidence to set forth the $5,000 was paid, and evidence was set forth that, in fact, only $1,100 was paid by Mr. Robinson.
I'm a little confused about your argument here. It seems to me that you're coming at this bribery statute and the defendant's conviction under it the wrong way. The statute doesn't set a minimum amount of the bribe. It says anything of value, right? Anybody who gives anything of value. But it has to be given with the intent to influence or reward an agent of state, local government, state or local government, in connection with any business transaction or series of transactions that has a value of $5,000 or more. So the transaction sought to be influenced has to have the value of $5,000 or more, not the bribe. The bribe can be of a lesser amount as long as what's sought to be influenced has the transactional or meets the transactional minimum amount. So it seems to me this statute is getting at transactional bribes that are given to influence government transactions, which is not what's at issue here.
Well, Your Honor,
you're going about this argument the wrong way. It's not that the jury was misinstructed or that evidence was improperly admitted, but that the evidence is insufficient and that the government's theory of this bribery prosecution isn't captured by this federal statute.
Your Honor, it's the value requirement of $5,000, you are correct, applies to a transaction or series of transactions. It is our contention that there was no transaction that was valued at $5,000 in part of this original agreement between Mr. Robinson and the investigating officer, Wayforth.
Right, because the bribe wasn't offered to influence the salary of the police officer, which is what was more than $5,000, or what the evidence showed was more than $5,000 here. The bribe was given to get the officer to look the other way and not police the streets so that this drug operation could proceed, which it seems to me satisfies most state bribery statutes, which are much broader, but doesn't satisfy this one, this federal statute.
It is our contention that the exclusionary limit of salaries not being applied applies to the entire statute. And as the Sixth Circuit...
And I'm telling you that's not the best way to argue this case, because there's something more fundamentally wrong with the government's theory here and the conceptualization of this bribe. And it's not by operation of the exclusion, which you're right, isn't limited to the first part or the second part of the statute. It appears to be broader, but that's not the fundamental problem here. The fundamental problem here is that this isn't a bribe offered to influence any government transaction or business in the sense captured by this statute. Maybe you could take my lifeline and run with it.
you're correct in that assertion as well, is that there is no requirement, that in this case, Mr. Robinson's bribe was necessarily, related to a transaction or a series of transactions. That is correct, and we agree with Your Honor's contention on that.
And that gets back to Judge Easterbrook's question. Is this a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, really, in disguise, rather than an argument under subsection C, the exclusion in the statute?
Well, as you're aware, we did assert it was a plain error argument in our brief, and as I assert that today. But it also can be considered an insufficiency of the evidence argument, and that goes to our final point, which is an insufficiency of the evidence argument, which relates to the government failing to prove that the city of Chicago received $10,000 of federal funding, which is another requirement under Section 666.
That just leaves me cold. The city of Chicago received millions and millions of dollars in federal funding. Your brief asked whether the police department received federal funding, but there's no such thing as the Chicago Police Department. It's not a juridical entity. It's just part of the city.
Your Honor, in this case, the government added to the record in their response a list of agencies under this Justice Assistant Grant, and that included the Chicago Police Department. It included, among others, other police departments in other cities, including outlying cities of the city of Chicago. But in those instances, in those cities, it listed the amount of money that was going to be received by those cities. In this case, no money was listed specifically what was going to be received by the city of Chicago. And in fact, under the city of Chicago's jurisdiction, there are other law enforcement entities. And it is indisputable that the government did not present any evidence that the Chicago Police Department itself received $10,000.
The Chicago Police Department is not a juridical entity. The juridical entity is the city of Chicago.
Your Honor, in this instance, the Chicago Police Department, or the City of Chicago, did receive the grant, but it was not necessarily to be used by the Chicago Police Department. And Officer Whiteforth was an officer under the jurisdiction of the Chicago Police Department. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Getzo. Ms. Stryker.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Sarah Stryker on behalf of the United States. If it's okay with the Court, I would like to jump straight to the issue regarding Section 666. The District Court committed no error in admitting evidence of the police officer's salaries in this case.
Right. As Judge Sykes said, and as I was also trying to get at, that's not really the question. This is not a question about admission of evidence. It might be a question about the jury instructions, but no objection was made. Or it might be a question about the sufficiency of the evidence. And perhaps it would be worth addressing it from that perspective.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would also like to note that in the district court level, the defendant did make a sufficiency of the argument, or sufficiency of the evidence argument, but has dropped that argument on appeal with regard to 666.
Are you saying that a Rule 29 argument is waived if not made in the district court, that it can't be considered on plain error review?
No, Your Honor. That is not what I was trying to say. The defendant did raise a sufficiency of the evidence argument below, but did not continue to raise that argument.
If this argument is properly characterized, as Judge Sykes characterized, it is an argument that the defendant is entitled to a judgment of acquittal because the evidence does not meet the statutory standard.
Yes, and I can address that, Your Honor. And the evidence here certainly did meet that standard. There was significant evidence regarding the value of the transaction that the bribe was intending to influence. There were many forms of evidence, one of which was the offer of the bribe actually made. The defendant offered the officer $1,000 per week. And as conceded by the defendant, there was no time.
I don't want to put words in my colleague's mouth. But the statute says any business transaction or series of transactions of such organization, government, or agency involving anything of value of $5,000 or more. So what is the transaction of the City of Chicago or of the police department that was worth $5,000 or more? The transaction was probably worth more than $5,000 to the crooks, but the question is, was it worth more than $5,000 to the City of Chicago?
Yes, and that transaction is the value of policing the City of Chicago, of preventing drug crimes from happening. That is one of the actions and a very important action of the City of Chicago and
that
the police department in particular.
Quantified.
Yes, and the courts have recognized that intangibles such as policing the community can qualify under Section 666. For example, in the Marmolejo case that dealt with conjugal visits.
It sounds like you're inviting a skilling problem, right? Isn't this the same problem as skilling? The government is trying to be creative in the use of a statute which is really designed to deal with bribery in the signing of city contracts. This isn't remotely that. So the prosecutor's trying to extend it in a way that it's extremely difficult to get out the language of the statute. And the Supreme Court has been told us rather vividly last June that we shouldn't be playing that game with criminal statutes.
The government's business includes many things other than financial transactions, and the business of the Chicago Police Department.
Does the City of Chicago Police Department keep a book of accounts that includes as an asset the, say, value of drug trade prevented?
No, I don't
believe.
It's not
ordinarily included as an asset in government accounts.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. However, the license to sell drugs, which is what the defendant got from this corrupt relationship with the officer.
The City of Chicago isn't in the business of issuing licenses to sell drugs.
No,
your
of course
conceptualization
not.
Of this bribery in that way, and that was in your brief, is way, way off the mark.
Well,
this isn't like, you know, a license that was given away in exchange for a bribe. You know, like a liquor license or, you know, a zoning variance or something else that the city is actually in the business of doling out.
Although the City of Chicago, and in particular the Chicago Police Department, is charged with policing the streets. And what this bribe was getting at was stopping the police department from doing that particular
right,
job.
Right, and that's an intangible. They can't be quantified. And so this misconduct, criminal conduct, is captured under state bribery statutes, but not under this very focused and targeted federal bribery statute, which gets at transactional bribes.
I'd respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because the, you know, the courts that have interpreted the statute have applied it to intangibles.
Beyond the conjugal visit case, is there another one?
I would have to look back at the record, Your Honor, but it was, you know, settled in the case law that these intangibles could qualify, and there was no argument below in this case that the, you know, policing of the streets couldn't qualify as something of value captured by Section 666.
Well, there was a sufficiency of the evidence argument preserved.
The sufficiency of the evidence argument was whether there was sufficient evidence to prove the value of $5,000. And in this case, there was significant evidence on that point, including the offer, the amount of bribe offered, the bribes handed over, and the amounts that the defendants did to profit from the corrupt relationship with the officer. That was what the sufficiency of the evidence argument below was going after, was
My understanding of the conceptualization of this was that the $5,000 transactional element was met, at least in the government's view, and in the government's argument in the district court, by the value of the police officer's salary.
That was one piece of evidence.
And
that was
the other piece of evidence was the drug deal, which can't form the basis of this count because the bribe wasn't offered in exchange for the drug deal. that's just...
Well, although the
preposterous, and you know, to the extent that there was an argument made that the intangible benefits of the police services that the defendant sought to divert away from himself, that there wasn't right. any basis in the evidence for that support for this claim. That's just not a transaction that can be quantified.
Although part of the evidence was, Your Honor, the offer of the bribe that the defendant made, which was a concrete, you know, offer of $1,000 per week, which the defendant admitted that he offered to the officer and, in fact, did make payments to the officer over a six-week period of time, and there was really no end in sight to that corrupt relationship at the time the arrest occurred, so a rational jury could conclude from that that the bribery relationship would have continued, you know, well beyond the $1,100 handed over.
The $5,000 transactional requirement, transactional element, doesn't relate to the amount of the bribe. It relates to the transaction sought to be influenced.
That's right. And I believe that the amount of the bribe is one way to value the transaction.
That can't possibly be right. That's not how the statute reads. The bribe doesn't have, there's no minimum amount of the bribe under the statute. There is a minimum amount of the transaction sought to be influenced, the city transaction sought to be influenced.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
The defendant didn't seek to influence any city transaction in this case. Well, he wanted the police officer to look the other way.
Which the government would argue is a transaction of the Chicago Police Department, given the Chicago Police Department's...
That's a real
reach. But of course, that's where Skilling comes in. As soon as you start saying this, the Chicago Police Department is vindicating the public's intangible right to good policing services, well, we know what happened in Skilling, indeed what happened in McIntyre back in 1987, and what happened in Skilling to an effort to expand what seemed to be a comprehensible statute through some intangible rights device. The justices aren't buying it.
Well, Your Honor, moving on to the other argument that was raised by the defendant, which relates to the sufficiency of the evidence on the $10,000 issue. There, the jury heard from Larry Sachs, who was the director of grants management for the Chicago Police Department. He clearly told the jury that he helped to seek out a grant from the Department of Justice that was focused on law enforcement efforts, and that the monies raised from that grant were to go towards things such as, or excuse me, go towards law enforcement purposes such as replacing worn-out squad cars, replacing worn-out computer equipment and handheld radios, and also money that would go towards CAPS, which was the alternative policing program. And from that evidence, a rational jury could conclude that the Chicago Police Department had received $10,000 or more in federal funding in the year at issue. The defendant also made no argument regarding the $10,000 element at trial and clearly thought that element had been satisfied, as the government believes that it was. The other argument discussed today by the defendant is the coercion instruction. As noted by the court, this should be reviewed under a plain error standard, and the defendant cannot show that a plain error was made here. The defendant clearly got the chance to present his coercion defense. It was argued by the parties in closing and read out loud, and the district court clearly read out loud that instruction to the jury. The defendant bears the burden of showing that there was an error made here, and his failure to raise this issue below puts the court in, would put the court in a difficult position of trying to figure out what happened. The defendant cannot show what happened and cannot show that a plain error was made. If the court doesn't have any other questions, in closing, Robinson received a fair trial, and the government requests that the court affirm his convictions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Getzow?
Just one point, referring to your honors questions to Ms. Stryker. The bribe cannot be used to satisfy the $5,000 requirement, as your honor points out. And in the district court, no other evidence was presented to otherwise value this transaction at $5,000. It is for these foregoing reasons that the defendant appellant, Mr. Anthony Robinson, respectfully requests this court to vacate his bribery conviction and remand the remainder of the case for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Getzow. And the court thanks you, as well as your law firm, for accepting the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.